What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the JTS Podcast. My name is Marcus Modi. We took a little short break from you guys, but it's finally to get the group back together and talking sports, just plain and simple. My name is Marcus Modi, alongside my partners, Patton Cook and Gabe Jones. How you guys doing on today?
It's chill. It's chill in the Ville, man. It's a beautiful day outside, and I'm happy to be back.
I echo those sentiments. 80 degrees 2 days in a row here in Clarksville. I'm sweating outside, walking to class. I mean, what's going on here? But last month really of being a student here at Austin Peay. So exciting times ahead.
Yes, sir. Patton Cook is almost done with the undergrad. He almost out that thing, as yep. Some of us would say. One more month left for all the students. Just grind it out. That's all I can say right now is you almost at that finish line. Yep. For everybody, not even just the seniors.
Y'all made it through a whole year of college with Corona. Congratulations.
You know what? I know how to wear a mask better than anybody, and I think in America, the amount of times I've had to wear that going to class. But we do what we got to do to get that coveted piece of paper that apparently tells us we did something. So I'm excited.
Yes, sir, indeed. But actually, we're going to keep it here in Clarksville and start with Austin Peay, because we found out a couple weeks ago that for the men's basketball head coach, Matt Figger, he's actually leaving the program and he's going to Texas. So University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. And they just announced their new head coach. Head coach Nate James coming from Duke, one of the assistant coaches from Duke. I wanted to get you guys' thoughts on Fig leaving. Was it a shock to you guys? And then was it best meant for Austin Peay just because of how rocky these past couple years have been?
I'll go first, and I'll let Gabe kind of fall behind. I was a little bit surprised, mainly after the season ended, and usually coaching changes, not many times is it like the coach's decision to like step away, especially when he hasn't had the best of seasons. And that's what Coach Figger had this year, all the talent, probably the most talented roster he's had in his time at Austin Peay. And he really probably had his worst year as a governor, which was kind of sad to see end. The Terry Taylor, and of course now Jordan Adams, that era is officially over. The Jordan Adams, he has transferred. He's playing down in a Texas, a college down there in Texas. But for Matt Figger, I was expecting, if any change was going to be made about a week or so after the OVC tournament, and I was expecting Austin Peay to make that move just for both parties. But whenever that didn't happen, I kind of, my guard was let down, if you will, and I was expecting kind of another year of Coach Figger. I know he's got a few different recruits coming in for next season, but it was going to be another new-look Austin Peay team, so I was a little bit surprised that maybe he didn't get out of town when he did. But about two or three weeks ago, rumblings on Twitter saying that he was taking a pretty good look at this Rio Grande Valley job down there in Texas. And for one, I'd never even heard of the school, to be honest, and that's no disrespect. I don't think a lot of us here in this area have heard of it, and I'm sure in Texas they haven't heard of Austin Peay either. So, I mean, it's nothing disrespect-wise, but not a job I thought he would take. I thought it was more he's looking for a step up. If anything, I think best-case scenario for him, this is kind of a sidestepping move. It's not a step up. I would hate to call it a step down, but a bit surprised in that avenue that Coach Figger himself took away from Austin Peay, but just from all the kind of rumblings that he never did find Clarksville really home. And I think that's a big thing for the family of the head coach and for the head coach himself. He just never found it to be his true hometown. So he's looking to make a name for himself down there in Texas. All the best of luck to him. And one thing you can say, and I think one thing we can all say, He sees talent. I think that's one thing. He saw Terry early on, even though he didn't really recruit Terry. That was a Dave Luce who got him on the campus. But he gave Terry the kind of green light from his freshman year all the way to his senior year. So, yeah, for all these kind of fans looking, what are you going to get from Coach Figger? I think he spots talent better than anyone. Got Jordan Adams. He's a pretty good recruiter. It's just whether he can put that full five together and make his style, because I'm not sure he ever got to implement his true style at Austin Peay.
Indeed, I'm interested to see how it goes down in Texas. To be quite honest, him in the red and black looks a lot better than him in the orange. I don't know if y'all saw the picture of him with his little orange cap on. But I do wish him success where he is. He did have success at Austin Peay. I mean, finished with a well over positive record. I don't remember any losing seasons while I was at school at Austin Peay. So he put up wins on the board. The team always did at least decently in the OVC tournament at the end of the season. So he did have some success, and I'm just interested to see how he does. I guess, as Patton says, kind of like a lateral step, a little size step, going to a different school in Texas.
I think for Figure, one of his biggest problems was not having consistency during these entire years. There was a lot of transfers, and hopefully once he gets to Texas in that orange, as Gabe said, he can get a same group of five guys and five starters. He didn't have that at all here at Austin Peay. Don't get me wrong. He was a solid coach. It's just he couldn't get over the hump. That's the thing. He couldn't get past the second round. Couldn't get to that championship game in the OVC tournament. And also, he had a lot of talent. Terry Taylor, the accolades are there. Jordan Adams, he had three straight freshmen of the years. You got to realize that.
Yeah.
Underneath his belt, he had a two-time OVC player of the year. He had the people that was there, just couldn't get it done. Fig is not a bad coach at all. Some people might question his tactics and the things that he does, but hopefully for once he gets to Rio Grande Valley, that consistency stays there, and he can push them forward. Because I think, like Patton said, it was somewhat of a step to the side because you always want to level up. And I think he was looking for that power five school, but nobody just, especially coming off a bad year at that, where you finished 500, but you was predicted to win the OVC and it just didn't go the right way. One thing I do want to point out, Fig did have an extra year left on his contract. So I guess he thought it was best for him to pull away now because it could have hurt him chances even more after that Terry Taylor era was finally over with and now Jordan Adams being at Lamar University. So Fig might have thought it was just the best idea for him to leave now instead of when it was too late.
And I really think this past year was always going to be his last year. I think if kind of the plan went to fruition, Austin Peay wins the OVC, he's getting a Power 5 job. And I think that's exactly what he wanted. And I'm sure that's exactly what he was hoping for, having Jordan and Terry both come back after declaring for the NBA draft last year. But once that never came to fruition, I think, I don't know, I just always saw this being a last year for Fig. And I'm sure this is not what he envisioned. But I think this next job is going to be kind of what he hoped Austin Peay would be. And that's a stepping stone to at least a more of a powerhouse program, whether or not be Power 5, kind of go to, I can rattle off a number, numerous different schools, but for Fig, I think there's going to be a decent test for him because I know not a lot of his coaches are going to go with him down there. Some of them are going to try and stay here at Austin Peay. Others are just kind of looking elsewhere. So he's going to start over and he's going to start from scratch. And I think that's one thing that enticed him was kind of just getting a fresh start because at Austin Peay, as you were mentioning, Marcus, he was kind of always like putting Band-Aids on holes. He never did have that true rebuild because one thing that Terry gave him in his freshman season was they were competing for the OVC. He never had that true kind of rebuild mode at Austin Peay. They're competing for that OVC title from year one. So I think there's a lot to be said that maybe he's just looking to build something because, of course, before coming to Austin Peay, the Governor's had Dave Luce, and there was a program built already. So I think this might be something he's looking forward to kind of building from the ground up. And I'm not sure I would have said this a year ago, but I'm going to keep tabs on wherever Fig is at down there in Texas, very close to the border. So it's an interesting hire. And then I guess we can go ahead and start talking about Austin Peay's new hire. I think the Duke name is just such a draw to anyone. I think it was going to be hard pressed for Austin Peay not to kind of take this chance on the assistant coach. And whenever you got Coach K and Jay Billis saying nice things, that is, they may be friends of them, but for me, they suckered me right in whenever you got Coach K and Jay Billis giving statements on your new head coach.
Yes, sir. It was actually the other day, just a couple of days ago when he was announced, Nate James, former assistant coach for Duke for the past 13 years, right under Coach K. And one thing he did announce in the press conference, hey, he recruited Zion Williamson and Brandon Ingram. Hey, that's two names in the NBA right now that's hooping for the New Orleans Pelicans. Hey, just saying that alone, he has that recruitment talent. And I think it was Coach K said it was due time for him to get a head coaching job. And I think this is a really good hire, because like we stated, like Patton just said right now, Dave Luce had a program where they won the OVC championship. Fig kept us in the loop, and James is trying to get us back into that championship level. That's what he's trying to do. He's going to start. It's going to be tough because everybody's going to think about that post Terry Taylor era, and everybody's going to want their high expectations. Hey, sometimes you got some tough shoes to fill, but I'm pretty confident that James is going to keep the program going steady and moving forward.
Indeed. Do you guys think that the Austin Peay team will see a dramatic rebuild? Do you think that he'll keep some of the talent that we already have around? And also with him having that Duke mantra behind him, do you think that we'll get some of the top recruits that we can get for Austin Peay being a D1 school?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And I think the OVC as a whole is starting to grow. I know we had a big recruit kind of go down to Tennessee State University. I think he was in kind of the 4 or 5 star range, and he's committed down there. So I don't think it's a far stretch. And the Duke name, even though he's not there anymore, in living rooms of mom and dads and players, I mean, that speaks volumes. So I think that's a real possibility. But in terms of the kind of talent on the roster right now, I just don't see many guys transferring with Fig. A lot of times you see that, but that is just such a far away from kind of where they are right now. Most of these guys are somewhat local, in the South, at least kind of in the Georgia, kind of Alabama level. But I don't see much change in that avenue, but I think there's pieces there. Carlos Paez, Chino, I think that's a building piece right there. Only a sophomore for Austin Peay. If he wants, he's got 2 more years here at Austin Peay if he doesn't choose to go into the transfer portal. And one thing you can say about him, I think he's one of the leaders on this team moving forward. He's kind of started right away as a point guard. And this year, I think he really took a real step in his offensive game, multiple 20-point games this year for him, and you know he's going to give his all on the defensive side of the ball as well. So I think there's pieces here for Austin Peay. There's not that clear star, I don't think. I haven't got a real look at all the transfers that have kind of gone away from the program. I know Terry Taylor is still in town. Of course, he was competing in the 3v3 competition this past weekend. If he wants, he's got a year eligibility. I don't think he'll want to – I think he's going to look to go to the G League. But I'm sure there's Coach James. I'm sure he's going to say at least something, just kind of get in the ear of Terry. And but I think there's pieces there for Austin Peay. One thing they don't have is that clear star, but I think recruiting, maybe not this year. I think he's come in a little too late for recruits, but I think next year on the recruiting trail, they can find that real star to kind of take this team where they want to. And that's competing with Murray and now Morehead State.
Yeah. I think for James, it will be this year might be a step lower than last year where they went 500 just because of the uncertainty with this team right now, because you don't even know who all is going to be on the team and who's going to be leaving. But I think moving forward, he can actually have one of the best teams in the OVC talent-wise, recruiting-wise. Like I said, he does a really good job, and he actually was recruiting for majority of his tenure at Duke. So it's more than Brandon Ingram and Zion. You got to think about Jahlil Okafor. You got plenty of guys, yep. The Jones brothers. You got plenty of guys who could vouch for James and he has that true sales pitch to get the talent that he wants to. Because you still got Belmont, you got Murray, Morehead State winning the OVC this past year. So you want to be in the mix if you are James this year, so you can recruit even more and even better in the years to follow. Because you got Pius, you got a couple young guys who don't have that just player of the year potential at the moment, but they can be solid players for you moving forward. That's the thing. I think James is going to have to just figure out and what he's going to do with his pieces and then try to move forward with that.
Sure is. And I agree. And I look forward to kind of the process, because I think one thing we can say, it's going to be a process. And I think that's something that maybe Austin Peay fans have kind of forgotten. I think this football OVC championship might have diluted a little bit to it's hard to win. And I think sometimes some of the fans, at least some that I've seen on Twitter, I think we got to remember that. And it's going to be a process, and I'm not sure if Big got a fair shake from every fan, but whenever that football team, whenever they lift that OVC title, fans are thinking, well, if we can do it in football, why can't we do it in basketball? But it's going to be a new look OVC with some new, maybe not new faces, but some old faces not in it anymore. Jacksonville State will no longer be in the OVC, but I look forward to that process, and I'm sure it won't be winning basketball right away, but I'm not expecting that. I think just a good product on the court will really give fans a lot to be excited about for the years to come.
Let's go ahead and move. I'll go ahead, Gabe. Yeah.
I was going to say, speaking of like transitions from bad kicking from a few years ago to good kicking, we got a W.
Right.
On a field goal. You believe it?
Yeah, Austin Peay in the last game against Murray State win 34-31 after a field goal by Paulette. Did I say his name correctly, Pat?
Yep.
Paulette nailed it. Was it 30? He mailed a 40-yarder and then a 33-yarder as well for the win. I wanted to get you guys' thoughts on the past two games as well, because Austin Peay picked up two top 25 wins. This past week, they beat Murray, and then the week before that, you beat Jacksonville State 13-10. I wanted to get you guys' thoughts on these past 2 weeks because, well, let me let the listeners know up front now is that Austin Peay won't have a chance to repeat, even though after these back-to-back wins, they won't have a chance. The two teams who will get an OVC get a share would be either Murray or Jacksonville State, and that depends on the winner of this upcoming week because they actually play each other.
Well, shout out to Coach Scotty Walden. This man came in, and he's done basically what he said he wanted to do. I mean, he knew it wasn't going to be like past years with as much success because you're dealing with roster changes and coaching changes and whatnot. But with these two last wins, I guess. Yeah. I mean, huge, huge wins going against Jacksonville State and Murray State, our rival. You got a change in quarterback. But we haven't really skipped a beat as far as trying to do what we're doing now to get some team, I guess, get guys together, get people to know the new schemes, the new coaching philosophies. And I am super excited for next year because I think this is going to be a really good team going into next year. But these are awesome, awesome wins. It'll be great for team chemistry and the mindset going into next year, trying to win it all.
And I think this is exactly where Austin Peay fans want to be when they beat Jacksonville State and whenever they beat Murray State, who was undefeated going into that game. And they're disappointed about not winning the OVC. I'm not sure if you would have told Austin Peay fans that 6 years ago that you would beat Jacksonville State and Murray State, who's undefeated, and you wouldn't win the OVC, that you'd be disappointed, because I think a lot of them would just be so happy to be in the position that they're in right now. But talking on the season, I think this has been one of the kind of more enjoyable seasons to watch. I think just as a neutral, of course, I'm not a neutral anymore going to Austin Peay, but I think the offense that Austin Peay has shown this season with freshman quarterback Treylon Ellis, I think this gives a lot to be excited for in the years to come, because one thing we know about freshman quarterbacks, they're going to make mistakes, and Treylon has made those mistakes specifically early. I think later on he's really started to mature and kind of understand what throws he can get away with and what throws that are going to get him punished and get his team punished. Nearly had one at the end of that Murray State game, maybe a little fortunate not to have the turnover in that one. But I think that is so exciting for fans to see a freshman quarterback who you know is going to be the starter. I think he's nailed down a starting spot for next season, no doubt. I don't care any transfer quarterbacks coming in. I think what we've seen from Scotty Walden is he puts the most trust into Treylon Ellis I think I've seen from any coach to quarterback in a long time. Because after week one, I think a lot of coaches would have moved away, and I'm not sure many of them would have been wrong in doing so, but he trusted his freshman. He saw something in practice to give him the confidence to continue on from week two and beyond. And right now he's sitting pretty because he's got a freshman quarterback going to go into his sophomore campaign with a lot of returning players on the offensive and defensive side of the ball. And I'd say they're early odds on favorite to win the OVC next season. But ultimately, the loss against Tennessee Tech in week one is going to come back to bite them. And ultimately, the loss against Tennessee State last year didn't come back to haunt him in that OVC title run. You just can't lose games like that and not expect to be punished. They got punished for that game, especially the UT Martin loss, which they were winning the entire game, but just let it slip away. But I think disappointment that they don't win the OVC, but I think they can take more positives than any team in the OVC without a doubt, just because how young and how really promising this program is becoming under Scotty Walden as head coach.
I think the Tennessee Tech game loss wasn't as bad as the UT Martin loss at home. Lose off a field goal at the last second. And then that loss there ultimately kicked you out, because you win that one, it would have been a three-way tie between you, Murray, Jacksonville State. And then you beat both Murray and Jacksonville State. So you would have had that back-to-back OVC champs. Mm. It's just that loss to UT Martin at home, that was a crucial one. Tennessee Tech, you could lose that one because, like, it was a lot of uncertainty, new offense, really a new defense as well. It's just a lot of things you're trying to figure out really fast. But that UT Martin loss, you had the consistency, you had the chemistry there. It's just that you couldn't get it done. Now, I will say, Patton, on the Murray game, Treylon scared me because he threw it into triple coverage, and that safety should have it went straight through the safety's hands. That's a totally different ball game. But hey, you know the saying, when you drop an interception, 9 times out of 10, the offense will score.
Yep.
And that's exactly what happened on that last possession, because he threw a deep ball to, I believe it was D'Angelo Wilson. Triple coverage, everybody
overthrew him as well.
Overthrew him by 3 to 4 yards. It was like everybody, it was funny because I was sitting there, I saw the throw happen, and everybody in the stands was like, who is he throwing it to?
Right.
Because they were just hoping that it didn't get picked off. Because you know the football minds. Overthrow, triple coverage. That was just what Patton Lillard say, a recipe for disaster. Yeah. But it didn't happen like that. And then I think also with that missed pick, it calmed them down. And Scotty also was like, okay, let's not try to take these deep shots. Let's just run the football, take what the defense gives us, give it to Amaya Tanner, who was averaging like 4.5 yards per carry, and just run down the clock.
And I'd like to talk on Amaya just a little bit, but this is a guy, this was going to be his year. This was his first year of really coming into camp where you look and he's the number one guy. And, of course, Brian Snead popped off in OVC play. I mean, just running like a man possessed. I think Austin Peay is going to have him. I don't believe he is transferred. I think he was just hurt. I saw on his Twitter that he underwent surgery. So they're looking to have him back next year. But for Amaya Tanner, he was running. He was pissed off for greatness in that game. He was running upset, and he was charging through tackles left and right. But this guy didn't have a lot of kind of chances to be the starter. Even this year, there were times when I mentioned Brian Sneed, he was the starter without a doubt. Ahmad dealt with injuries, but in that game, his final game in Fort Terrace Stadium, I'm happy for a guy like that who stuck it out. A lot of chances for him to go elsewhere if he wanted to. He stuck around here in Clarksville, and he won them that game, I think, because how he was running it in that second half, it really won Austin Peay the game, because it gives the freshman quarterback, Draylen Ellis, you just turn around and give it to that guy, and he's getting them 6 and 7 yards. So happy for Ahmad in that case. One thing I will say, the defense last year for Austin Peay, such a stout opponent to come up against. And there's really not a lot of guys missing in that. Of course, the secondary started to face some injuries. Jonathan Edwards went out in the game against Murray. Isaiah, a good friend of all three of us, he went out a few games ago with a knee injury. But for that defense, I think this offense is starting to maybe kind of hinder it just a little bit. And I think that's something that Scotty Walden's okay with living with, the high-tempo offense. Doesn't allow the big guys on the sideline to kind of rest up. I don't know what you guys think about that. Do you see the defense? Is it possible to kind of be as dominant as they were last year, or even hold up some teams? Because there's some games where they just can't seem to get a stop if their life depended on it. I don't know what you think, Marcus or Gabe.
I'll go ahead and then I'll pass it off to Gabe. For me, I think sometimes Scotty doesn't give the defense time to rest. Because for me personally, the fast-paced offense is a risk-reward style of offense. Because I say it's a risk-reward because when you score quick, oh, yeah, it's lovely when you score in 30 seconds, a minute. But the risk is your defense is going to get tired, because if on the other side, they're going 20 plays, 15 plays, 18 plays on their drives, they don't have time to rest. And we saw this a lot of times, because in the last year, the defense wasn't giving up 40-point games, double overtime games, where they're giving up 35-plus. And now it's been getting – they're in the upper 30s in the past couple games, and it's very questionable. Even – for instance, the Jacksonville State game, you win 13-10. The defense gets 6 turnovers. Just constantly getting a turnover, And it's not equaling up the points. Over time, they're confident, their confidence level gets lower and lower over time. And sometimes I think what these offensive coaches don't realize is, hey, you got to realize when to speed it up, when to slow it down, give your defense a break. Let's do a 20-play drive here. If we can get a 4-play drive in the first couple drives, cool. For touchdowns, cool. But don't try to rush it when we don't have to. That's the thing. Just understanding when to rush and when not to rush will help out a defense a lot.
Yeah, and I think that whenever you have the talent on offense that Austin Peay has right now, Ellis, Tanner, Wilson, you want to just go out, score, 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 which is great. But like you said, you're not giving your defense any time to take a breather. You have a running back in Tanner, a guy that you can hand the ball off to, a guy that could be your workhorse, that could suck up some time off the clock and still get you to move the chains. I think that you should do it, especially in times when you see that your defense may be struggling later in the game. So, yeah, they will have to work that out. But I'm sure Sir Walden will get something going for next year. Will Wilson be back next year? Was this his last year?
So from what I understand, any college player that played this year has got an extra year of eligibility. So it is really up to the player at this point. I think when it comes to D'Angelo and especially Cordell, if they've got any sort of draft grade, I think they're going. And I just think it would make sense. For me, I would leave for sure, and I'm sure for them that's what they're thinking. I'm not sure what that is. I know they've gotten a lot of hype from the FCS media. I just don't know what it's like in the draft. We'll find out here. And I think the draft is 3 weeks from today. They will not be called on night one, but I think day two or three, I think keep your eyes open. And even undrafted free agent. That's the one luxury they have. Until they sign an agent, they're really up to do whatever they want. So I think it is there for them if they want it. I think if they're not picked up by an NFL team, I'd expect them to be right back here at Austin Peay. If that would just be my guess, because I think another year under this offense, that's more stats and that's more interceptions for Cordell for pro scouts to look at. So we'll have to see.
Yeah, I think they're going to test the waters first before fully coming back. So we don't know. This year has been really strange for them because certain guys could have just said opted out and was like, I'm just going to strictly focus on trying to get to the league. But they risked it. They risked getting injured. They risked just for the love of the game, and they're out there balling. Can't say anything else for them about that. Hey, we just hope for the best for them because they both – I know Cordell had like at least an 85 PFF grade right now as a nickelback. And I think and that was coming into the season. And I think it upgraded up closer to a 90.
He is such a fun guy to watch on the defensive end because myself calling the games this year, I was catching myself because I was just watching Cordell. I wasn't watching anything else other than Cordell because he would just kind of go all over the field, blitzing, kind of dropping back in coverage, man on man. I think he's a Swiss pocket knife for an NFL defense. I think I'd love to see him in the preseason. I don't know how many regular season snaps that Cordell will get, but I think if you get this guy on the field in the preseason, he's going to make a play that he's got himself, I think, a spot on an NFL roster somewhere just because of the athleticism and the amount of things he can do. So best of luck to all of those guys. Of course, as Austin Peay grads, they're soon to be Austin Peay grads. I would love to have a few Govs in the NFL for sure.
For sure. And even if they somehow don't get on the NFL roster, I think they can ball out in the Canadian league. Most definitely. It's like Tiny Moore. He's still balling out right now to this day. But let's go ahead and send it to a quick break. When we come back, we're going to hit on a little bit of UFC, got some March Madness, as there was a lot of madness in this March. And then also we're going to finish it out with a little NFL trades that happened over this past week. We'll be right back with more on the JTS podcast.
Yo, welcome back. Welcome back. And you guys, we're about to hit on some March Madness because we're going to keep it collegiate, going from Austin Peay all the way to the NCAA tournament. Okay, so we'll start off in the Final Four. So Baylor played Houston, Baylor number one seed, Houston number two, and then Gonzaga played against UCLA. We'll start with Baylor-Houston. Baylor gets the 78-59 win over Houston. Now, Houston made their way through the tournament. They were a high seed. They climbed, scratch clawed, made their way all the way to the Final Four. I don't know if you guys follow Memphis basketball, but Memphis lost to Houston on like a bank shot three. I think that they lost to Houston on like just the final seconds, yeah, both times. Everybody feel like Memphis should have been in the tournament. I feel the same, but disrespect from whoever sets up these brackets. But that's neither here nor there. They lose to Baylor 78-59. Your guys' thoughts on that game?
Wait, one thing I want to point out. Memphis did end up winning the NIT tournament this year.
And, yeah, what's up with the disrespect to Memphis, bro?
It's just they had a lot of bad losses during the regular season. That's the only thing I wanted to say on that. But go ahead, Pat.
I will go ahead and start, I guess. So, for Baylor in this one, kind of like a game we'll talk about in a little bit, there was no doubt. Just from the very tip, you could just kind of tell the difference between the execution-wise. I'm sure the talent, I'm sure you could look out there and on any given night, I'm sure it wouldn't have been like that specific game. But Baylor just looked too long, too fast, too physical, and they could shoot the ball way too good for Houston on that night. And when you just look, I think this is a real indicator of what we were going to see from the national title game. But there's a lot to be said about what Houston did this season, and there's a lot to be proud of. But ultimately, I hate when you kind of get blown out in the Final Four game because it really just I would much rather lose, I think, in a close game in the Final Four because it really just kind of diminishes all your accomplishments getting there. And I'm not sure how much good many of these Houston players are going to remember from this game or from this year as a whole, because I think there's a lot to be proud of. You make it to the Final Four, but you just run into a buzzsaw who ultimately wins the national title in Baylor. But they really didn't have one guy that jumped out to you. Jared Butler had 17 for Baylor in this game, but really it was just about everyone. Everyone was getting double digits. Everyone was hitting threes, and everyone was making a defensive contribution. So I think this was a real kind of look in on what we were going to see in the title game. But for Houston, a great season. It ends in, I hate to say embarrassment, but when the bright lights are on and when you get beat like that early on and there was just never really any doubt, it's a tough one to see for those kids for sure.
Yeah. One thing coming into this game, it was going to be a defensive matchup between both teams because both teams was top 15 in defense. Baylor was top 10 in both offense and defense. And I think that was a difference maker, just being both defensively sound and fundamentally powerful. I mean, offensively powerful. I know Houston's best player, Giroux, he didn't have his best game, even though he was. People failed to realize he also did hurt his hip earlier on in the tournament, but kept playing through it. He was a warrior, I will say that. He just didn't have his best game, finished with only 6 points, 3 of 10 from the field. And when your best player is struggling offensively, it's tough, especially in the NCAA tournament, because it's only one game,
yep.
Just plain and simple. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that Houston would have won in a series. I think Baylor still would have won in a series. It's just that sometimes when you have your best guy not scoring, you need those other guys to come and help him. And it just didn't happen for Houston because they typically go on a 7 or 8 man lineup. But for Butler, they're 8 guys. As you saw, even in the national championship game that we're going to talk about later, they're loaded. They was loaded nonstop from top to bottom. Baylor just overpowered them early on and just throughout the entire game. At the end of the first half, it was 45 to 20. So Houston just couldn't get anything done, and Baylor just cruised. That's essentially what they did.
Indeed. I mean, I think that they were ranked – 5th coming into the season, Baylor was, and for good reason, as we saw over this entire tournament. I think that their closest win was maybe 5-ish points, but other than that, they were basically blowing teams off the floor the entire tournament. So, I mean, not really different, nothing different coming into this Houston game. On the other side of the bracket, We got one of those amazing NCAA March Madness moments.
No.
The final score being 93-90. This game went in the OT. This is UCLA versus Gonzaga. And we got excellent performances from the top guys. Drew Timmy dropped 25. Joel Ayayi, he had 22. Suggs with 16. And then on the other side, Johnny Zhuang had 29. Every guy in the starting lineup, I believe, had double digits for UCLA. So it was a back and forth game, and somebody had to take the cake, and that was UCLA on a buzzer beater three.
Oh, Jalen Suggs.
UCLA. Yeah, my bad. Gonzaga from buzzer beater. Yeah, buzzer beater three from Jalen Suggs. First question, Patton, did he call bank?
I don't know. Just how pure the bank shot was, I almost want to feel yes, because, I mean, that thing literally hit the backboard and bounced right in it through the net. That thing did not think about touching the rim, but what a shot from Suggs in that game. And I think without a doubt, the game of the tournament, and I think this is going to be played for years to come. The buzzer beater is going to be played over and over again, but I think this is going to be played on the college basketball classics, because I think from minute one to the final buzzer, I think UCLA, I tell you what, there's a lot to be proud of from those guys, because every time that Gonzaga looked like they were going to make a run, they kind of make a 7-0 run to kind of take a lead of 4. UCLA, they'd hit 2 threes and they'd get right back into it. They'd be up 2, and just anytime they needed to make a shot, they would find somebody to make it. And I think from Cronin, the head coach over there, I think he's got a bright future down there at UCLA because he's really the fourth option. UCLA was trying to get John Calipari. Then they moved to Rick Barnes. I'm glad they didn't get Rick Barnes for that reason because Rick would have been bounced out in the round of 32 probably. But UCLA's got to be happy. And I think ultimately college basketball needs those blue bloods. This is really the only blue blood in the tournament that had a good, successful tournament. The Dukes, the Kentuckys, the Kansas, the Michigan States, they're all out. Now for UCLA, they were in there. Bill Walton, of course, was having an absolute field day for him. But it was a great game for Gonzaga. What more can you say? I think they were pushed to their limits in this game, and I think there's a lot to be said that they kept on responding because I think they just must have been so exhausted with this undefeated season. They were looking to do something that hadn't been done in a long time, going the entire season unbeaten. But they did exactly that in this game. They moved on to the national title game. But just from 1 through 5 for Gonzaga, they showed up when they had to when UCLA gave them all they could handle, a game we are going to watch and remember, I think, for a very long time.
I wanted to say shout out to UCLA for being the second team ever to be in the first four and make it to the final four. That alone is a hard task to do. From day one, you having to fight just to get for a spot. And they just battle each and every week nonstop. It was amazing just to watch. Juzang, he was going just up the leaderboards with the most points in a tournament. I think he was third most points in UCLA history for the NCAA tournament. It was just a back and forth and fair. Gonzaga, they got rattled in this game in the second half, especially down the stretch. UCLA, that's another thing I wanted to point out. UCLA is not a good defensive team at all throughout this entire year. And the thing that just kept them in this game was they were just hitting shots. But I think both teams for majority of the game was shooting 50% from the field. It's 45 to 50. So it was like neck and neck whenever they just needed a shot. And one thing for sure, Jalen Suggs is a top 3 pick. I don't want anybody to fool you guys. He was a top 5 pick coming into this tournament, and he finished top 3. The block that he made and then the full court pass through 3 UCLA defenders to Timmy on a dime for a dunk, that's something that's going to be played nonstop, like Patton had said. And then you got to add on the bank 3 in overtime.
And that's I think if you close your eyes and you listen to a radio call, if they would have said LeBron James instead of Jalen Suggs on that sequence, I don't think you're surprised at all. I think that's exactly what NBA teams are wanting because he's doing it on both ends. Of course, he's got the shots to remember, but I think from minute one to the buzzer, he didn't have his best game, but when they needed him most, he was there to make that defensive stop and that assist to really, I think, make the push to end up winning that basketball game. But what a game it was. It kind of spoiled the national title game. Gabe, I'll let you explain it for us.
No, indeed. That was an excellent run of plays for Jalen Suggs. It was insane. He just did everything on the court. So going into the title game, Monday, April 5th, shout out to my cousin. That was his birthday. Happy birthday, cuz. Baylor going against Gonzaga, both number one seeds. Baylor known for his patented zone defense. And then, of course, they were top 10 in scoring in offense. Going against this Gonzaga team, Gonzaga being the team that was undefeated. It's only been done twice, I believe, in collegiate history. The last time was in, I believe, like the 70s, where a team went on to be undefeated throughout the whole college season and throughout the tournament. And we got to see what would happen. Why it's so hard to be undefeated? Because Baylor wasn't playing. Baylor was not playing with Gonzaga coming into this game. I think that they hit double digits in scoring before Gonzaga even scored 1 point. I believe it was like 13-1 at one point in this game. So were you guys surprised that Baylor just came out and slapped the taste out of that bank shots, that beautiful taste of the bank shot win. They just slapped that taste out of their mouth just coming in. Patton, what'd you think of this game? Were you surprised?
I was going with Gonzaga in this game, mainly because I just couldn't see another team like UCLA. I mean, they had to hit every shot to keep Gonzaga from running away in that game. I know Baylor, number one three-point shooting team in the country coming into that game. I know they got some shooters. I know they play good defense, but I just figured Gonzaga, they've got 1 through 4, really, that can go for 20 each and every night. And ultimately, it didn't matter because the Baylor defense, there's a clip going around where they've got one guy flying into the bench. He's sprinting around. They've got the team defense. They're switching on onto each other. I think that clip really exemplifies that entire game because once Gonzaga, they cut it down to 10 going into the half, and I was thinking, here we go. This is going to be where Timmy gets to do a few of his mustache showboating, if you will, in that second half. But ultimately, that was as close as Gonzaga got because Baylor pretty much took control in that second half, ended up winning the title game. And one thing I will say, so happy for Scott Drew, of course, the brother of Bryce Drew, the old Vanderbilt head coach. And he's kind of been through the ringer because we were talking about Coach Figger building up a program. He built that Baylor program. And when they had RG3, the football program, all the highlights going on over there, they were in the shadows down there in the Baylor basketball program, but they've got it right where they want it, winning a national title. And I don't think they're going anywhere because recruits see that and they see the style of play and they know that they're going to have a few guys drafted. That's going to be so huge for that program. But I hate it for Gonzaga. I was kind of hoping for it, hoping they would finish out that undefeated season. Kentucky tried to do it a few years ago, ended up losing to Wisconsin, but ultimately, it's a tough thing to go undefeated, and Gonzaga is yet another team to find that out the hard way, this time losing in the national title game.
I think the last time that this happened was 76, was Indiana State to get to the national championship game, and they actually lost as well. But for me, when I saw the matchup between Baylor and Gonzaga, I actually thought Baylor was going to win. Now, keep in mind, I will say this, when I made my bracket, I had Gonzaga winning it all. I'm not gonna lie to you guys, but when this matchup happened, I actually thought that Baylor was the better complete team because I knew that the guards, that the key to the game, and I know Kenny Smith has said it a lot, if you have the best big man, you have the best guards, I'm gonna pick the guards. And because the guards dictate the game, and I felt coming into this game, Baylor defense and the harassing of that defense with that pack line defense, it was going to be tough for Gonzaga to get good looks. They had a tough time trying to throw it down to Timmy because when he had those mismatches, Baylor would quickly front him. So, and then make it a tough entry pass, lobbing it to Timmy because that was going to be weak side help. So coming into this matchup, I was like, hey, Baylor got a shot at this. And people kept just riding in Gonzaga. Baylor had a really special team. Yep. You got to realize they was top 10 in both offensive defense and number one in three-pointers made. That is a stat line that's hard to lose. Just plain and simple, that's hard to lose when you're both great offensively, defensively, and you can hit the outside, the long ball. It's just a tough way to lose. And then Jalen Suggs, he didn't have a best first half, but he came back strong in the second half. It just was too late. Whenever Gonzaga tried to hit a run, they could never get it to Pat lower than 7. They couldn't get it to 7. I think 7 would have been that number to try to change momentum because whenever the momentum happened, you had Butler, you had Vital, you had Mitchell, you had guys for Baylor, that was just, okay, you're going to have this run. All right, we're going to take that away from you, and then we're going to get a quality bucket to end your momentum. And that's really was the outcome of the game. You know, basketball is a game of runs. It's just that whenever Gonzaga tried to make a run, Baylor just hit him with the not so fast.
Nah, facts, dude. Nothing was going right for Gonzaga. I think Suggs got into foul trouble early in the game, so he didn't get to play until, I guess, like the 12-minute mark, 13-minute mark, actually get real quality minutes. But then while he was out, basically they were missing free throws. They were getting out-rebounded. Baylor was getting tip passes, open layups. They were getting open layups and open three-pointers in the half court. Just nothing was going right. And then you look at the halftime stats. They were getting out-rebounded, out-shot from three. Just if you're going to get out-rebounded and the other team is making more threes and a higher percentage split than you, you're going to lose. You're just going to lose. And it wasn't being out-rebounded by like a small margin. It was like 7-8 rebounds. So it's just tough, as well as Gonzaga coming in with the pressure of being an undefeated team looking to win that final game. That's a ton of pressure on your team. And look, pressure make diamonds, but pressure also busts pipes. Yeah. And somebody had a water leak in the game.
And to Marcus's point, whenever you're playing great defense and you're making threes, I'm not sure there was not a team in the country that was going to beat Baylor that night. The way they were playing, I don't care. I think you could put some NBA teams in there, and I think they would have had a tough time beating Baylor on that night. Just when they were making threes and the intensity on the defensive level that they were playing, I think there's just not many teams that were going to be able to beat them. So congratulations to Baylor. I think they're now officially a powerhouse in college basketball. This is a few years now that we've seen kind of them in the tournament. Of course, you had the famous Torian Prince getting out-rebounded by Yale. That's not happening anymore. Torian Prince, a Cav now. So I can joke about it. He's been a good acquisition for my Cavs. But it's a new year of Baylor basketball, and it's good for them.
Indeed. All right. Well, that's March Madness. Patton, you going to hit us with some UFC?
All right. We had a very good UFC event that has been making my mouth water for months. The whole Francis Ngannou and Stipe Miocic 2 first matchup was a Stipe masterclass or a Francis disaster class. I don't know what you want to call it, but that fight was really not close, but really the expectation coming into this one that it was going to be a lot more, at least competitive from Ngannou's side. He's learned a lot. But before we get into that main event, I would like to break down a few of the main card because it was a very good main card, I thought. We'll start first with that Sean O'Malley and Thomas Almeida fight. And really, Sean, he had this one pretty much controlled the entire fight, but he's making a mockery out of the UFC, trying to make a highlight finish, turned away after getting a knockdown, could have finished Almeida off, I think, in that first round, but decided to turn his back to it. Gabe, have you seen anything like what Sean O'Malley did in that fight and ultimately didn't even cost him?
Dude, Sugar Sean, I mean, this dude is – he's basically like what Connor was doing with his talking, except he's doing with the hands. Yeah. He just absolutely flashy in the match. He's throwing kicks. He's throwing feints, just knocking dudes out. And he basically did that in this fight as well. It wasn't really competitive until Sean, he knocked him down. He didn't go in for the finish because he thought it was just going to be a walk-off knockout. And then Almeida, he kind of fought back, tried to figure things out. And then eventually just Sugar Sean just figured him out again. And he got that highlight knockout that he wanted and even had afterhand, like after he was already out, went in and he decided to finish him with one more hit. But excellent performance from Sugar Sean O'Malley. I am very, very interested to see every fight from here on out.
Yeah, Sean was trying to get disrespectful with Thomas, trying to do a little walk-off. But, hey, it was just a dominating performance. I think he controlled the fight the entire bout. I think coming in also – a lot of people had Sean winning this fight. Was just going to see if how early the KO was going to be, honestly.
Sean, a -330 betting favorite heading into that fight. And his point about not wanting to just do a regular kind of finish was he only gets 15 minutes twice every year. So he's got to make the most of it. And he certainly made the most of it in that fight. Moving on to the co-main event. And a sad one for a lot of UFC fans. Tyron Woodley fighting in what is his likely last fight in the UFC. His contract is up. after this. And Marcus, I'll start with you, and a little bit of a different tactic than what we're normally seeing from Tyron. He came out swinging early on, but it did not pay off for him in this fight, finished in the first round.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a UFC fan, you've been watching Tyron for a very long time. You know he love to throw hands, but he is not it on the ground. He just them legs ain't the best ones. And the older you get as well, too, sometimes you gotta not so focus so much on what them hands can do and get work on that takedown defense if you know you're not the best on the ground. And it was just sad to see, honestly. We didn't want to see Willie go out like that. You would want him to see him go out with a nice little shot, nice little right hand haymaker. But it's just unfortunate, man. Is it sad because I'm not surprised? Is it bad that I'm not surprised that the outcome happened like that where he got submitted? No. I don't know.
No, man. He hasn't won a fight since like 2018. He got dominated by Kamaru Usman to lose his championship belt. Ended up losing to Colby Covington as well as who is this? Gilbert Burns. Gilbert Burns beat him.
Oh, that was a bad one. Burns was a bad one.
It was awful. It was awful. And then Vicente Luque, he came in, lit him up. Could have knocked him out. He ended up getting him to the ground and basically grabbing him and pushing his big old shoulder into his face and like just choking him out. It was awful. And honestly, Dana White is clapping his hands and rubbing his hands like Birdman. He was like, yes, finally I can get this man off my books. Because apparently Dana White and Tyron Woodley don't have a love-hate relationship. They have a hate-hate relationship. So Dana is happy. Happy that this is over for Tyron. I am happy that Tyron can hopefully finally get out of here. Hopefully he managed his money well and not take any more brain damage because it has not looked good over the last few years.
Yeah, as I mentioned, likely his last fight in the UFC. Talk that he might go over to Bellator, a kind of lesser competition. Of course, Michael Chandler now going to fight for the title in his weight class. That's where he came from. So we'll see. From Woodley, just ever since the Usman fight, it's kind of been a rough going for him.
I mean, he could go to one, like Demetrius Johnson. That wouldn't be a bad one. But, I mean, Demetrius Johnson just got KO'd last night.
Tyron might have been tuning in. He's like, maybe I won't go. Maybe I won't go over there. But of course, Tyron, likely his last fight. And to your point, Gabe, no happier person than Dana White. Him and Tyron have been kind of going back and forth for a long time. So likely that's the last we'll see of Tyron. Now to that main event that we were all waiting for, as Bruce Buffer would say, inside that octagon. The second time that these two has faced off. And Gabe, I'll start with you first. Of course, Ngannou coming out of here with the victory, the knockout victory. Did you see this one coming? Did you see another Stipe masterclass coming? Or did you see that Stipe or Ngannou, he's a different fighter. He's a smarter fighter. What was your take before coming into this fight?
Coming into this fight, Francis is a scary man. Coming out of this fight, Francis might be the most terrifying man on the planet. All right, so coming in, I thought Stipe would still keep his weight. In the first fight, Stipe came in, he had some, like, love handles. Yep. This dude had some weight on him. Coming into this fight, I didn't realize Stipe lost 30 pounds. I think Francis came in, weighed in at, like, 265 or something like that. And Stipe was, like, 235. So I'm not sure what the idea was on losing so much weight. You can't throw around your weight as much, nor can you take damage as much. So you're fighting a dude that's 30 pounds heavier, that's way more athletic. And we saw what happened. Once we saw, it was a moment in this fight where Stipe tried to take Francis to the ground and Francis stuffed that takedown, it was over.
I was just going to bring that up too. I was just going to bring that up because I was say Gabe literally took everything I was about to say because like coming into it, I thought Stipe was going to try to get to the ground and whatnot because he had he had the weight, but then we heard that he was 25 pounds. Francis was 25 pounds heavier, and I'm like, oh, that ain't looking too good for Stipe. And then in that moment when he tried to take Francis down, didn't happen. I was like, it's a wrap. I knew it was a wrap because once them hands happened, it was over with. You saw that head start coming back with them punches, ooh, them jabs. It was over with.
It sure was. And for Ngannou in this fight, the only thing I can think of for Stipe being that light, I don't know if he was hoping that he could kind of evade Ngannou, kind of use his quickness with less weight. But to your point, I think Stipe found out pretty quick that the strength that Ngannou had was going to be more than anything he could have imagined. And I think, I don't know if that was, that must have been the plan coming in. You don't come in that low if that's not the plan, but never did go right for him. Ngannou ends up getting the knockout pretty early on in that second round, 52 seconds, and he wins the title. And Ngannou was the betting favorite coming in, coming into this fight. And kind of the ending of it is now that the talk is John Jones. And, of course, Dana White kind of had his little chuckling saying that if I'm John Jones, I'm going back up to light heavyweight. John did not find that as funny as some people did going to Twitter pretty much immediately after that. Gabe, what do you see? Do you see John kind of stepping into that octagon with the big boy, Francis Ngannou, if he's paid, or do you see another matchup? Because really, this heavyweight division, it is officially Francis Ngannou's picking now.
If the price is right, if they're going to pay the man, then John Jones is definitely going to fight. He's definitely going to fight. Thing is about John Jones, we've seen very close fights in the light heavyweight division. Even some that people said maybe John Jones possibly lost. And we haven't really seen John Jones knock anybody out. So we'll see him go up to a heavier weight, see if he can. I mean, if anybody can beat Francis, John Jones is the guy that I would bet on to do it. But he did gain a lot of weight. He'll be a little bit slower. And we'll have to see what their chin is like for John Jones against a heavier guy. So if the price is right, definitely down to see it. I'm paying my money to see it. So please, Dana, pay the man. Please. I need to see it.
I would love to see that fight. It's just that the thing is with me, I agree with Gabe. If anybody's going to beat Francis, it probably would be John Jones. It's just that we also got to realize how heavy Francis is going to be in that fight. Because if he's 25 to 30 pounds heavier than John, and with that power, I don't know. I personally don't know, because I know John, he got one of the best takedown defenses. So he ain't going to be trying to get to the ground. But still, that weight is going to be a different. I think the weight would be the difference maker for that fight. Also, I don't know if Dana's going to just drop the cash for John.
Because he should.
I think this has been Dana White's MO. He has rarely ever kind of given the fight that we all wanted to see. He took forever to kind of give fights that we all want to see. Couldn't get the Khabib Conor 2 fight. And I think the whole thing with John Jones, he said from the very beginning, if that price is right, I'm fighting. Whether or not that comes to fruition. One final question, and we'll talk about the NFL here in just a moment. Marcus, I'm going to ask you this question. Stipe, of course, losing this, getting knocked out. It's not the prettiest sight for the resume, but I don't think there's any shame in that. A lot of men have been knocked out by Ngannou, and a lot more men are going to be knocked out by Francis Ngannou. Where do you put Stipe at the – I think in the heavyweight, I think he might have a case to be the best, because beating Cormier, I think that really puts you at the very top of the heavyweight division. Where do you put him in all pound-for-pound Stipe Miocic? I don't know if you have a take on where you put Stipe right now.
He's definitely top three. I believe he's definitely top three. It just depends on the person's perspective, honestly, in the heavyweight division. If you Stipe, man, he has a resume too that people fail to realize. He has some quality wins at that. I think he could be two. Like I said, he's automatically top three. I know for sure. For me, he's got to be at least two. Gabe, I don't know what your thoughts on it, but I think he's at least two.
Heavyweight. Oh, go ahead.
If not, yeah, I think he's definitely two.
Heavyweight, I got him number one. As far as like a pound for pound guy, I think there are guys that are more skilled as far as and more dominant in their area. Stipe, he would take some time between his fights dealing with injuries and whatnot. As far as skill, I think we all have like John Jones, maybe number one, GSP, like a Mount Rushmore of guys. If you had to take four, I wouldn't put Stipe up there as far as pound for pound, but yeah, definitely dominating his division. As far as the heavyweight, he's the number one guy.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Like, if he's at least two. Yep. That's the point. Yeah. He's at least two. There's no argument. He's at least two in heavyweight. Now,
I agree. I think he's right next to Khabib. Of course, Khabib not losing is obviously going to probably give him the edge for a lot of people, and I think even me maybe. But now let's jump over to the NFL. We've had a few trades right before the draft. We are 3 weeks right now, recording it on a Thursday. 3 weeks from today, we get round one of the NFL draft scheduled to take place on April 29th. Very excited for it, and we had a few trades. First up, we've got the San Francisco 49ers. Marcus, they have jumped all the way up to number three in the draft. And the word on the street is they're taking a quarterback. And I don't know if you want to touch on it, but that quarterback, what looks like they're taking, going to be Mac Jones out of Alabama.
I don't understand it. I don't – me personally, we can go more into detail when we do that NFL draft, but I'm just going to say this. If it's me and I'm the 49ers, I think Justin Fields would be a better fit for the style of offense Kyle Shanahan goes. But that's all I'm going to say right now. I'm going to leave it for when we do our NFL draft pod.
I think that the 49ers just want to steal the Patriots quarterbacks. So there was some chirping about if Mac Jones fell to where the Pats are. Not sure that he would or not, but if he did, we would take him. And the 49ers heard about that and they decided to trade up and they were like, forget that, we're gonna take them. So we'll see what happens. New uniform,
right? And that final trade before we get out of here, Marcus, the Jets, they have shown their hand and what they're going to do at number two. They have traded away Sam Darnold. They've gotten a second and third round pick in return. They've got a war chest of draft picks in the next couple of years. What do you make of Sam Darnold? He's heading down to Carolina. Do you like that fit for him?
For me, I think that's a great fit because you got to realize he had Adam Gase as his his offensive mind. Yeah. Matt Rhule and Joe Brady, I think they're going to help him out a lot. And not a little bit, probably about a lot better. Right. You got Robbie Anderson, you got one of the best running backs in football at CMC. You got DJ Samuel and Curtis as well. I think this is a well-needed change of scenery for him.
And Gabe, you've seen Sam Darnold as he plays your team twice every year for the New York Jets. Have you seen flashes from him whenever he's kind of getting out from the umbrella of Adam Gase? Ryan Tannehill's done it in Tennessee. Now he's going to have a chance down in Carolina. Do you see any bright spots in Sam Darnold, or do you think this kind of be more the same from him?
Well, the Panthers are trying to tank, right? Congratulations.
Hey, they did the correct thing because now, I mean, if Kyle Pitts is available, pick all up right. Kyle Pitts, and then, hey, you got a loaded offense because you went all out on the defense last year. Just go lock up offensive guys.
A great point. It gives you a year.
Yeah, hey. I think who do y'all think will win that? Is Bridgewater gone? I thought they signed him.
He's still there. No, he's still there.
So they're going to have a nice little QB battle as far as the defense and then the rest of the offensive weapons go. We'll see how they mix it up. Yeah, but if you were trying to tank, I think that they made the right move. I'm not a big believer in Sir Donald, so we'll see.
I'm a bit conflicted for me. I just think of Adam Gase, and maybe this is foolish of me, but I think any quarterback under the Adam Gase system and the Adam Gase team, it's going to have a tough time succeeding. I wish all the best. He's got Christian McCaffrey. Worst case, you just turn around and hand the ball off to him. Marcus?
Hey, when in doubt, check it down. That's all I'm going to say. But hopefully it's a rejuvenated Sam Darnold while he's in Carolina. I know a lot of Panthers fans was hoping that Teddy Bridgewater was the answer. Didn't really look like that much. But like I said, you draft Kyle Pitts, or if somehow one of those Devontae Smith, Waddle, Ja'Marr Chase, one of those guys. Hey, that's still another solid
scarf
pick.
Scarf him up.
Scarf him up and pick him up and let them get some running. That's all I'm going to say for the Carolina Panthers. But that's all that we have here on today for another episode of the JTS Podcast. We appreciate you for listening and tuning in.